I want to take 10 seconds to channel that energy right now. You down to channel?
For sure.
Do we need to like look into each other's eyes or anything, or eyes closed?
Since we're partners in this, we can just take a moment and acknowledge that we're both trying to bring a spirit of help. Now we can just be funny too, right? Dude. Like we don't have to be so serious, but we are trying to be helpful. So that's what I want to channel.
Okay. I freaking love this already. We started this podcast, which is, I guess, slightly happening right now. You talked about channeling energy, and I'm down to do some, like, you talk about pre-gaming, not using alcohol. Let's pre-game, dude. I want to pre-game with
you. Yeah. So sometimes, it's not like a thing, but sometimes I have these conversations with people, and I'm like, I have no idea what I'm doing, and I have no idea where this is going to go, and there is no, like, journal or playbook for how to deal with complicated things that I've never heard or thought of. Mm-hmm. So sometimes I walk into situations, I'm like, I have no idea what to do. And so what I do is I just get quiet and I just ask to find the right words so I can be helpful. So I try to just bring in the spirit of how can I be helpful? And that's, I would imagine that's not what a volleyball team does. I don't know if it's going to, like, they say, hey, let's all be helpful, but I'm just like, that's the best I can bring.
That's really interesting because I, as a volleyball player, I definitely, before every game, do a pregame meditation, visualization, in some way, channel the energy, the environment I'm about to be in. But I never thought about bringing that to, like, a conversation or, like, a different space I'm entering.
Yeah, no, I try to bring it. Sometimes I just phone it in and don't think about anything. But
I feel like that's me most of the time.
but certainly I like to in my best self, I try to just say, okay, how can I be helpful? And that's the extent. And I literally take 10 seconds and I just think like that.
Okay. Welcome to Tallest Podcast on Earth. It's been a while. I am here with Dr. Adam Silverstein, Mr. Dr. Adam Silverstein. And before we start this, I want to take 10 seconds to channel that energy right now. You down to channel?
For sure.
Do we need to, like, look into each other's eyes or anything, or eyes closed?
I've never done it with someone else because I'm usually doing it to someone else. But since we're partners in this, we can just take a moment and acknowledge that we're both trying to bring a spirit of help. Now we can just be funny too. Right. Dude. Like we don't have to be so serious, but we are trying to be helpful. So that's what I want to channel.
Okay. I freaking love this already.
Okay.
I knew about you through Danny. We don't need to get too deep into this. My brother is a songwriter, so it's Danny. They met each other. That's how I got to know you a little bit. Over the last probably 3 years, I've dealt with kind of like my season, my career is gonna be over soon. Feelings of depression. I've had problems with anxiety and addiction and all sorts of things under the sun, which I can't wait to dive into a little bit. And to be clear, this will not be a therapy session about me. We're going to keep it for the people, which is really the point of doing this, is I want to share a little bit of my experience and hopefully speak for the voice of the volleyball community and just people in general of the range of emotions we can experience as humans. When I found out you were a psychologist and addiction specialist, let's say, or that's where your interest really was, I was like, oh, this is the perfect guy to talk to, because I've been pretty quiet on social media and pretty quiet with the podcast for the last month or so. And it's because the emotions I was experiencing felt so heavy and new to me. And I wanted the kind of re-entry into that world to be with someone like you. So I super appreciate your time letting me into your son's guest house, your own place. Like, this is means a lot to me, so I appreciate you being here.
So thank you. Danny is my son, and I'm in my other son's room, and we're in this space, so it's my pleasure. I love my kids' friends, by the way. That's like plural. I have four kids, and they're wonderful. So any extension of them is always welcome here. We have a super open house, as you can probably tell.
The irony is you remind me, I don't even know you. We just met and you remind me so much of Danny. It's hilarious.
Wow.
Okay.
That's cool.
Tell me a little bit, just like for those listening who don't know you and I don't know you, just like a little bit about yourself and what you do and how you got into all this.
How I got into all this mess. So, I'm a lot of things. I'm a dad. I'm a husband. I'm a son. I'm a brother. I'm a friend. I'm a father-in-law, right? I'm also a psychologist. That's my profession. And, I kind of got into it because I couldn't really think of anything else that I could do. It just sort of,
that's hard to believe.
It's kind of true. I wasn't like, I'm like, oh, is there, what should I do? My peers were all going like law school or business or medical school. I'm like, I can't really do that stuff. So what is it that I can do? And I'm like, it just seems sort of natural. I'm a curious person. I really am. I'm super curious about how things people work. So it was just kind of a natural fit. I probably, as a younger person, didn't channel it for good. I could weaponize that. You could weaponize that curiosity too. But as I got older and more mature, and went through my own stuff, I saw how, listening is kind of, part art. And really hearing beneath, really, really, really listening in a curious way is not boring.
I got to be selfish for a second here. How did you work on being a better listener? Because I, my whole life, have been like, talking is how I felt like I process things. And I've learned a lot in the last 10 years, especially about myself. And I've noticed that I like to talk as a way to really better understand how I feel. And part of the problem that I encounter a lot is not actively listening, or someone's talking to me, and the second they start talking, I have those inner dialogues.
Yeah.
Like, how do you begin to work on the art of listening?
I'm probably not a good conventional listener either. I talk a lot, but I think when I say listening, I'm just like, just honing in on certain things and subcontexts has always been like curious for me. It's not just the words. It's a subcontext. It's more, in some ways, more nonverbal than verbal. What does my son call it? Reading the room, right? Mm-hmm. There's a certain read that's going on that just keeps me engaged. So it's not like I'm sitting there quiet while someone's purging. I have a lot to say and I'll even interrupt people, but I'm listening. I don't know if that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, I guess it does. I just like, I can only speak from personal experience in some way, but I find it so like, for me, if I catch myself having a hard time listening, if someone talks for, God, it feels like more than 5-10 seconds, I do this thing where I go like this. And it's like an active way for me to like actually engage with the person that's speaking.
You're just trying.
I'm trying to listen. And in some way it's like, it tricks me into like, what? Like being more engaged. But it sounds like you've, over the course of some time, I mean, to be a psychologist, I could imagine like listening is an important part of that.
I would say it's part listening. Also just, I'm curious about the story people tell themselves. And you're getting more of probably me at age 54, being around the world for a little while and sort of seeing a lot of pitches. And I'm not saying I've seen every pitch, but with a lot more to see, but I've seen a lot of pitches, and I've become very curious about people's kind of bullshit story they tell themselves. So I think everybody's got a narrative. And a lot of times it's just a self-serving narrative and they're sort of locked in the loop of the story they tell themselves. And you know what? There's no two identical stories. There are probably themes, but I'm interested in how people experience and tell the stories of their lives and what's important to them and what's not and how it all unfolds. And it's not even like critical bullshit. I just mean that we get so locked in. We get so locked in. Everybody does. Almost everybody I know into what's going on. And it's hard sometimes to live in your own brain. Hmm. So there's something about having an outside, not me listening, you know, not me, the person sharing, that is powerful. Because it's really hard to, you know, be in my own mind type of thing.
And why do you think we have like such a hard time expressing those things just into general everyday people, or even to people we're close with? And I speak based on the fact that I feel like even in my, like the volleyball community, and granted, I feel like mental health and awareness is like, it's coming up. Let's say it's trending right now. And I guess, I don't know. I the more I experience emotions that I'd never had before, I was like, wow, if I consider myself someone like super honest and vulnerable and not afraid to discuss what's going on, if I'm having a hard time managing or figuring out these emotions or kind of afraid to talk about them in an open environment, like I could only imagine that all of us in some way like are dealing with shit, you know?
So some people are good at purging emotions, because they can identify with sickness and they sort of...
What do you mean exactly purging emotions?
Meaning that they're very, very, very good at spilling their feelings and just getting out there and belting it out, right? Mm. And some people, it depends where you come from and what, you know, and what's driving you, right? So I would imagine in certain communities, if I'm a pilot, right, I probably don't want to announce to the plane that I'm having a panic attack, right? So I think there are certain contexts where you have to act more contained. Hmm. And if you're a part of a team and you're right, I'm guessing that you have to, there's a sense of keeping it together and keeping your poise
for the collective
and holding yourself together as part of the, is part of what we celebrate. Like I can be in game time, you know, end of the game, fourth quarter, you know, super composed, right? Mm. So maybe that character has a harder time, and it's more, there's a pride element of, I can't say I'm hurting. Mm. I can't show that side of myself. Whereas if I'm a teenager, right, and I'm sort of all over, you know, I'm all over social media and I'm really digesting content about A to Z sickness, I can really, really relish in the identity of being a mental health patient and love it. Hmm. So I see it really depends where you come from and what your circumstances are. I think some people really enjoy the identity of mental health. Hmm. And so much so, and this is maybe a little controversial, it's the opposite of keeping it together. Maybe they're identifying too much with it. So it's probably about finding the proper balance of when to share. You know, I had a mentor who used to say, when people would come to rehab, if you never share, start sharing. If you're always sharing, stop sharing. If you're never angry, find your anger, right? If you're not a crier, start crying. And it wasn't about always cry. And, you know, and if you're always, he said, if you're always crying, stop crying. It's about recalibrating. Mm. So it was to me about finding the right balance of what needs to be shared if I'm somebody who doesn't share, and what needs to be contained if I'm an oversharer.
That's it. Thanks for coming. That was intense. Man, you hit on so many different things that I would love to dive deeper into. You know, one being, I mean, we just recently, so I play with Team USA, and we just recently like met as a team and more or less talked about this type of subject of sharing, because on one hand, you're right. Like we practice, and we just had a guy named Pete come, and who's a Navy SEAL, come and talk about teamwork and resilience and that type of thing. And
that's a big buzzword.
Resilience,
mental health. You know, you said it's trending. Resilience has been trending for a long time.
And in what way do you mean?
Just it's a powerful word in the space I'm in. Resilience is, I hear that word a lot. Right, it's a great word. Right, it means it's not just about being in pain. It's about coping with pain. It's about building a muscle of dealing with whatever comes my way, whether it's traumatic or not.
And how do you like, where do you go to begin to find balance, right? Like you said, and for myself, like, probably I'll give an example. 2 weeks ago, I was in the weight room and I'd been dealing with some things that I want to get
into. I don't want to forget about Pete.
Don't forget about Pete.
Okay. I'm going to track Pete. You don't lose Pete.
Don't lose Pete, dude.
Okay.
He's a hard man to find, honestly.
The Navy SEAL.
Yeah, obviously. Yeah. He could be one of us, you know?
Okay.
But I experienced like heavy emotions of feeling so overwhelmed, so unsatisfied. And I didn't feel like I was in the weight. We finish a practice. We go to the weight room straight after that to work out. And I had this huge urge to start crying. And I'm with 30 other guys who are all working out. And I was like trying to hold it, like trying to fight it. Like, why? Like, there's everything was fine. What's going on? Like, why do I feel this urge to cry? And I went outside and was just like, get it together and just like kind of let myself cry, but was just still just kind of like, what is, like, I have nothing to point at. Why am I crying? Like, what's going on? Went back in the weight room, started working out. And someone at this time, you're like kind of seeing guys you haven't seen in a while. And so there's like, hey, what up, man? How are you? How was your season? And someone just asked, like, yo, how are you, man? And like, that just triggered this feeling of like, oh my God, I want to cry so hard. I want to almost cry just talking about it. And it made me think about what would have happened if I just cried in front of 30 dudes and someone were to come up and be like, dude, what's wrong? And to have me just be like, nothing's wrong. I'm just sad. And this idea of accepting certain emotions, especially in as a man, I guess, you know, and like, a lot of sports culture is like being resilient and not crying and working hard and working through things. And like, I bring that up because I'm in my own life trying to find like the balance between expressing how I feel in an open and vulnerable way. And that's a part of what I'm trying to have these conversations for, is to lead the charge in some way to be okay with accepting those emotions. And at the same time, I feel like I don't want to affect everyone around me by just like crying out of nowhere or just, you know, being so heavy that then it affects other teammates in the way that maybe they're training or thinking, or, you know. So I guess my thought is like, where do you find the balance in understanding and accepting emotions and being resilient,
right?
Expressing those.
It's funny you're saying this. I'm watching Ted Lasso, and the show. It's really, really, it's really, really a good show. And I think, I'm not going to spoil anything for those who didn't see it. I encourage. What's that?
Spoil it all.
No, but there's a real tension between being nice and oblivious in the show and, you know, sort of distracting yourself from all the noise and the noise. Here's this guy who walks into a world he knows nothing about, but he brings sort of he imbibes the idea of, I am the coach who, I pay no attention to winning and losing. I pay no attention to anything except, you know, I'm going to channel kindness and effort and my sense of unity, whatever it is. And how I think the show does a great job saying that that can't be the only force, right? There has to be, and the main character struggles with symptoms, even though he's super nice. Right. He has to find, he's so nice, but he's also so bottled up. So he's only seeing the world in one way, season one. Right. And what he grapples with is he has a lot of pain and it has to come out in different ways. Right. So he has anxiety, he has anger, right. And he has to find a way to connect to that instead of just being this sort of goofy, all I see is wonderful and everybody I'm completely forgiving all the time, right? And so it doesn't work for him as a character.
Okay, just in trying not to get lost in that beautiful representation. So taking away from that, like trying to find the balance in creating an environment, and I guess this would be for coaches too. I think that has a big part of creating an environment that allows your players to express themselves. But more so for me, like the emotions that I experienced almost gave me empathy for people and understanding. I mean, we talked about before this channeling this energy to be our best selves or be who we are right now and give our like full present attention to what we're doing, with this idea of like, you know, I feel like 2 hours from now, I might feel completely different. And then I'll wake up and might feel a little different, and that we carry with us the emotions that exist presently. And I think sometimes, especially in a team environment, it's almost like you have to just flip the switch and be the guy to play volleyball or be the guy to be a part of this team and have this resilience. And I don't know, in some way it made me think about like, where does it exist where, like, what would it look like to be on a team where it's okay to cry? It's okay to experience different types of emotions and to learn to teach and build empathy for one another. And in fact, I think it would bring a lot of teams and people closer.
So just to qualify, in no way, shape or form, am I a sport? I'm the opposite of athlete.
I saw that basketball hoop in the front yard.
It's not for me. I know you play basketball. I have two sons and two daughters. I know you've played basketball with both of my sons, and however good or not good they are, I'm really not good. So, I kind of need a lot of extra assistance. I swim, but it was a long, this is a shout out to my swimming coach who spent, you know, what usually takes people 2 months. I spent a good couple years with, I'm really hard worker. So, but now I said, I want to be master swim eligible. I want you to invite me. And then I want to say no. And anyhow, I got invited 2 years later to the master swim class. Shout out to Coach Dan. His wife was actually the head coach at UCLA women's swim team. And so I know what it's like to persevere. I wouldn't say, and you can certainly interview him, and he would confirm. It was really hard for me, so I don't know much about team sports, and I don't know much about how to cultivate a sense of unity in a locker room. But I will say this, because of course I've got a lot to say. I think there's a time and place for everything. I forgot the biblical line, but there's something about, in every, you know, there's a season for everything. There's a season for love. There's a season for hate. There's a season for war. There's a season for peace. I'm not sure even if I agree with, I don't know if there's a season for war, but I will say, just in embracing that theme, that there's a time and place. And if I don't do an oil change with my emotions, they're going to come out sideways. So if I'm in an environment that's sustaining profound denial, let's say there's an elephant in the room and nobody's really wanting to address it and it needs to come out, right? If I'm not acknowledging, you were talking about, if I'm not acknowledging that there's a sadness and a loss in a career coming to an end, if I'm not acknowledging that this is high pressure, right? And I stuff it and I stuff it, I just think it comes out in different ways. So if I were gonna reinvent myself as a coach, that is a bad idea. But if I did, if I ever came, right, if I ever came into that space, I would definitely have an instinct that if I'm not creating an environment where people could have oil changes with their feelings, then it's gonna affect the entire environment. It's gonna affect the whole culture. So a good culture to me would be knowing the time and place to say what's really going on authentically. And if I were an athlete, right, and I was thinking about what would that mean to me, and this is also based on my experience working with people who were, you know, high level athletes, it's, man, that is a lot of pressure. Right, that is a lot of pressure, and an expectation to be poised, right? An expectation to contain it, and to be able to walk through it all, and not only walk through it but excel, right? Especially during the hard times, right? That's when you're really measured, right?
Sure,
right? You're really, really measured in the last. You know, you think about people who are known for their chokes, right? Right? They're known for the moment that they couldn't execute.
Dude, what a bummer too to be.
And you're so good, right? And you're known for that moment. So the world wants you. That's what the world wants from you. Be the best in crucial moments. And I say crucial, like I'm kind of making fun too.
Sure.
Like how important is it?
Yeah.
Right? So it's really important to you, obviously, and it has a big, it's really important to you to be excellent in the crucial moment, crucial sure. as defined by succeeding so you can win this event.
For sure. And you're leading me a little into, you know, as I have gotten closer to the end of my career, I'm 31 now, I don't plan on playing for 10 more years. The cloud is looming, you know, in some way. I want to dive into that a little later, but I kind of want to dive into just like a bunch of different kind of emotions and just talk with them with you. And one thing I want to know is just about childhood. So personally, I've seen a therapist. Like, I started seeing a therapist probably 5 or 6 years ago. Wasn't a big fan of him, left. As of this last year, I started seeing a somatic therapist, which is a different style, obviously. But he asked me not even too long ago, he was like, ask your mom what you were like in the womb and what were you like for the first like 6 months. And that's such a small part of like the work I do with him. And I don't want to make like that somatic therapy is about children or childhood, but it did for the first time really like make me wonder how much of the things that I did when I was really young up to like teenage years, up to the brain fully develops around like 25, like how much does that stuff really affect the adults we become?
I don't know. So I think there are a lot of portals and entry points to connect and experience. And mental health wants to sort of say, this is the way. And I speak with humility. I know that that's a formula, is really, really dive deep to early childhood experiences. And they will be the shaper of everything moving forward, such a powerful imprint. True, right? But also true, right? If I'm a nice kid, and you know, I'm home and I get my first schooling experience and I'm overwhelmed and I, you know, I'm in third grade and I'm bullied, right? That could be the critical moment. So I don't know what to, I kind of like meeting people where they're at. Again, I'm a curious person. Sure. I'm less curious about infancy, but I'm more curious about where, you know, the story as it unfolded, you know, where do the pain points begin? And a therapist who's into, you know, early childhood experience would probably be saying, you know, it was all a buildup and I'm vulnerable because of an experience that led me to collect these sorts of experiences. Then it all weaves in together. And, you know, I get the most information from the here and now. I think it tells me a lot. So I don't know when the big influence happens, right? Some people's big influence happens in high school, right? It's such a tough time, right? It's like you're competing and you're vying for, you know, I once read an article that there's like very few people who felt confident in high school about their social station, and memories really imprinted at age. Like people always say, like, I remember 18 really well. And there's a reason for that. I think developmentally, what the article said was that both you're more impulsive and you're more afraid. So you're registering, you're willing to collect more crazy experiences if you think about adolescent years.
Sure.
And you also get scared, and the social order is so complicated. So you're competing for the top seat. So you're very aware of who's who socially, and that most people, even if they were seemingly cool, were afraid of losing their station on, you know, and it's a super stressful time. And maybe there were some people who sort of breezed through it. There used to be this idea that it's inevitable that adolescence is a stormy time for people. It's not a stormy time for every kid. Some kids can walk through it well. All this to say, as someone tells their story, I don't know where that point of significant impact is going to be. It could be anywhere.
And I guess when I ask that question too, I think about addiction being one of them, you know, and I know for myself, when I was 15, I started smoking weed every day up until 22 and battled with drug use and kind of all across the board, tons of different things, but smoking weed every single day. And as I've gotten older, not to get like super in detailed on those things, but as I've gotten older, I've recognized when 7 p.m. comes around and I'm overseas and I'm by myself, I'm very isolated when I'm overseas, 7 p.m. comes around and it's time to just chill and watch a movie and decompress, I always have this urge of like, I want to relax at like 100% or something, you know? Or like, and so it makes me think a lot of when I, my shitty bullshit story that I'll tell you that goes on in my brain has been, oh, well, because for so long it was like, I just had that little thing that elevated every experience that I did in some way. That now I struggle with just like being a sober guy, like going to dinner with friends at 7 p.m. and just enjoying conversation or sitting down and just enjoying a movie. And it's something I've wrestled with so much as I've gotten older. Like, I wonder how much those years affected my ability to just like relax and be present and just enjoy a movie. And so that's why I bring some of it up too, in the sense of, for my example at least, like how much of those experiences that I had in my adolescent years affected me now, and more so how difficult is it to rewire the brain into like healthier habits, you know? Like, what part of us is like such an imprint that it's just like, well, I'll always be competitive, and what parts are like, maybe we'll always be competitive, but you know, maybe I can alter these other things about me to bring more balance into my life, or you know, do you understand what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, for sure. So I'm just I'm taking it in, and I'm just, my sense of addiction, I look for relief when I feel bad. I look for relief when I feel good. So I'm always looking for either feeling better or an feeling better or feeling even better, like even more better. So I'm constantly, I've trained myself to create experiences where there's always room for better and more. Mm. So, and you talk about, could that be developed? Does that have to be, could that be developed or enhanced from substances? For sure. So I found something, and in addiction, like you said, age 15, right? Some people find, you know, relief substance in food early on, right? Some sort of relief experience, and they train themselves to say, I'm constantly adding this part of life, which is I always am seeking relief.
Or winning, maybe.
Or winning, feeling, or right? Something, or something to give me, if used inappropriately, right? It's a constant pursuit of relief. And so one of the things that I was taking in your discussion is profound boredom, right? Is a strong feature of addiction to me. So, you know, so that I'm so restless. It's so hard for me to sit with myself. What's the perk of that? So I tell myself a story. The only way I can sit with myself is if I add this thing, because that will be the perfect relaxer, right? Mm. So I need that. I kind of need that story. It wouldn't be as good if I just said, let's just go get high. And what does it offer me?
Right.
So I kind of need the story. So is the story true, or do I need the story to access the substance? So I don't know, right? Sure. Do you get where I'm going with this?
Yeah.
I kind of think we need the story to justify the substance more than the story it's true itself. So I may be bored, I may not be bored, but I definitely want to have the boredom story in there so I can set, it's the setup, it's the assist. To use athletic language, it's an assist to the relief, which is the weed.
Yeah, and I have brought this story up to past therapists and just friends, people in general have talked openly about it. And I had a therapist once say that it was more so like, what were you suppressing? And I found it interesting because when I was like 15, 16, 17, I didn't feel like my parents didn't beat me, you know, like I didn't feel like I was running away. I was a very fortunate kid. And looking back now, I feel like I lived a very fortunate life and got to do what I loved. And now I get to do that for a living. Like, it never felt like something that was negatively impacting my life. I wasn't screwing up in school because of it or hanging around a bad crowd. It was like, it was in some way communicative and fun and didn't feel like I was suppressing anything. And that's why I found it interesting for you when you said, what did you say about like, doesn't have to be something bad. It can be like, or having a better time, like, or wanting to have a better time.
It's, well, if I'm truly reaching a point of I'm a slave to a substance, I need it for everything. Right. So it's going to be enhancement to any experience. Mm. So it doesn't just have to mean that I'm in pain, right? It could mean that I'm actually having a good time. I just want to have a better time. And so one of the things that I think that I have to be careful about in my field is a colleague of mine studies the efficacy of therapists, the effectiveness, right? And I don't know if, at least based on the studies he's reading, I don't know if we're doing a great job. I don't know if our consumers find us to be the best helpers, but there's a subset of people who are considered really good therapists. But he said, as we get older in the field, we speak with more conviction and we have more confidence in ourselves being an asset. And the reality is that the older we get, the less effective we are.
That's interesting.
So I think that we get super confident in our positions. So who knows? Who knows? That being said, I work with addicts, right? Here's my hit rate of addicts that I think have low self-worth, 100%. So 100% on some level have insecurity and low self-esteem. So I'm pretty, it eventually comes out, right? That on some level, it's a pain reliever. It's an enhancer, like I said, but is the substance use always directly related to that? I don't know, but as we unpack things, right, there's a profound sense of insecurity. It's hard for an addict to sit with themselves and just be.
Well, it's so funny because like addict seems like such a, like addict sounds like hair. When I hear addict, I'm like heroin or something like intense, you know? And I feel like I don't associate the word in its true meaning. It could be addicted, like you said, to food. It could be what we see now is like people addicted to their phones. I had a roommate who every time he woke up, our alarm would go off and we have to go to breakfast or something. And he would just go straight to his phone, Instagram, just scrolling. And like, arguably that's just as bad as anything else. And so I guess my thought is like, are there positive addictions? Like, are all addictions bad? You could be addicted to loving someone. Is the answer just lying somewhere in balance? I guess maybe not with all things, but.
So everything, I can start off really, I'm not the anti-substance.
Sure.
I worked in prison for a while, for a long time.
What do you mean you worked in prison?
I worked as a psychologist in a prison for many years. So I've worked with a lot of different places with a lot of different cultures and, you know, all different sorts of walks of life. And so I've seen a lot. And when someone is preoccupied with something, it's not a crime to like drinking.
Sure.
Right. It's why I'm not the anti-drinking. Sure. I'm not even the anti-drugs. Sure. I think it should be legalized. I think, especially working in the prison system and seeing sort of the people who are being punished for things that if they came from more money, they wouldn't have been had the same sentences. Mm-hmm. It's not a fair game. And I'm not sure that's the best method of treating, drug offenders, but that's a different topic. But you see, like, there's a point where it's all good. I'm not like the institution of wine is wonderful, right?
Sure.
But at what point does someone cross a line? What point does someone go from like a cucumber to a pickle? Sorry, you can't go back to being a cucumber, right?
Is that not how that works?
Yeah, I don't think once you become a pickle, I think you're stuck a pickle. I don't think you're going to, I think it'd be a big ordeal to get you back to taste like a cucumber.
Sure.
Right? So once you cross a certain line, you're a slave to the situation and you're so preoccupied with it and there's not, and it robs you of room. It robs you of the proper room for other things. So it's when someone becomes a slave to something that, I believe it robs you of a certain experience because it creates an obsession, right? Mm. A total preoccupation with the experience. And it's a weird one because you kind of don't know you have it and everybody else sees it a little bit before you and you spend so much time protecting your right to have the experience that it's really hard to take in the information from the rest of the world that like, hey, you know, you're overdoing this.
I feel like our ability as humans to rationalize the story we tell ourselves is insane, at least for myself.
Like, well, so we'll speak about it through the lens of mental health. So what sustains, well, let's talk about addiction, right? Because I enjoy talking about it.
Yeah.
So to sustain addiction, and it's crazy, right? To sustain, if you're in active addiction, right? And addiction could be addiction to cocaine. It could be addiction to food. It could be addiction to sex, gambling. So, and I don't want to overuse the word. So, you know, it could be, I think gaming is going to get in there, like video games.
Yeah.
I've seen people like just hiding from life 13 hours a day. At that point, it's got to be in the same space, right? Of I'm so preoccupied with this thing and I'm not able to participate fully in life, or it's robbing me from relationships and other things and it's hurting me. So what sustains that? Like, because if I saw it in someone else, I'd be like, that's effing crazy, right? Mm-hmm. So what sustains that sort of behavior? So to do that, I need certain ingredients. So for addiction, I definitely need to have the ability to shrink the gravity of the information, the reality I'm in. So denial. I need to minimize and say, it's not so bad, right? Some people go say, I don't have a problem, right? So I need that ability to say, this isn't an issue. And I need to be able, that's one. And the other point I need is I need to be able to blame other things for my issues. So I have this really, really, really good ability to kind of avoid the subject, the real subject. I'm like, hold on, we're talking about you, but you're so good at deflecting. So that keeps, that's an example of what keeps addiction alive. So it keeps, and it's really important to me, right? If I'm an addict, and I certainly know in my own personal life about this, right? It's really, really important to keep alive the option to have my relief. So if you mess with it, if you mess with it and you try to corrupt my disk, if you try to create a virus, right, I'm going to fight you with denial and blame.
Sure.
So that's addiction. And addiction is a big deal because it's having addiction, I call it capital A addiction. It's everything else. Everything. If I have addiction, addiction is my biggest problem by far. And this is a debate within the field. Some people say we have to get to the underlying issues. I say, first, we have to tackle the addiction because depression and anxiety that occurs in the context of addiction is, to me, very different than depression and anxiety as a standalone absent addiction. So addiction, once it's in the story that I have that option, I can say, oh, I'm so anxious, I need this. Or I can use my therapy as I'm traumatized, therefore I should use. Right. Mm-hmm. So this is not everybody agrees with me. And even sometimes I don't agree with me. So, right. So I say that with, again, we're all theorizing. That's addiction. Anxiety, right, is, and you can have addiction and tons of anxiety, especially when you stop using the substance.
Sure.
Welcome scaredy cat. Right? Sure. Anxiety is sustained by a belief that there is a profound threat in the environment. Right. Mm. Now it may not be true, but on some level I experience that something really bad is going to happen. So I either try to avoid that thing at all costs or I endure it. But in my process of the environment and my reality is I have to be constantly vigilant for the threat that's coming. Right. Now to some people, getting on an elevator isn't a threat.
Sure.
Right. Yeah. But to other people, it's like a war zone.
Hmm.
Bad things can happen on an elevator. Right. So if you talk
about Bob? You ever seen What About Bob?
Yeah.
Come on, dude. That's our family movie where he steps on the elevator. Crazy OCD, this guy.
Right. So I remember. So that's, but if I'm an athlete, right, my universe could be, it's terrible if I don't succeed to the next level. It's terrible. Hmm. It's the worst thing ever. Right, it's so serious, right? And sometimes I think about characters in show business and how, as a society, we sort of, you know, give them a lot of pass for drugs and certain things. Like the show must go on. I'm like, who said? Mm. At what point should the show get stopped? Mm. Right, and we sort of take it for granted. Like, no, you know, we have to have the performer. We have to. So we'll set a whole team of babysitters and or doctors prescribing things to help it go because the show must go on. And so when I think of this in the context of obsession or anxiety, I'm like, who said let's take a step back. What does winning mean to you, right? And if it's creating a narrative of winning is everything, right? Even if you do win, is it free to win? I don't know. You're the athlete.
Well, I mean, you make me think a lot about balance, really. And when I'm hearing you talk too, I think about, you know, you mentioned video games. And I know first of all, I think in some way we're all competitive. Like everyone on Team USA, everyone where I'm playing professionally overseas, we're all really competitive. And for me, it was getting addicted to the process of being a professional athlete that got me to where I'm at. I was very, very much built as an athlete, not naturally gifted with this 40-inch vertical and 6'10". And I am tall, 6'5", but I had to build myself. And for me, I got kicked off of a second team at Hawaii, University of Hawaii is where I played. I went to UC Irvine, got in trouble for mushrooms and smoking weed, went to Hawaii, got in trouble for kind of the same stuff. And I had this moment of, I'm done. And it was this moment of just like, I can't be done. This is my identity. There's no way. And I was able to, like, things worked out to completely redefine myself physically. 4.0, just like I had one semester to prove, like, please, like, take me back. And ended up doing that. But what I learned is I got so addicted to, oh, I can see the 4th Ave or the 6th Ave. Or the, you know, like, I started getting super addicted to the process. And I think, like most of us do in some way, to get to the level we're at, there's some, and maybe I'm using the term in the wrong way, but for me, it felt like an addiction to and eating healthy and doing all the things right to get to where I want to be. And then you play overseas and it's this beautiful experience. And I got to live in Italy and you do it again and again. And now I'm on my 8th year playing overseas and I'm 31. And to me, it's now feels like so much more about outside of volleyball. And that I've identified as a volleyball player for so long, even though I was like, oh no, but I'm also very curious and so many other things I like to do. But when I had it taken away, it made me realize like volleyball is actually a huge part of my identity, even though sometimes I think, you know, philosophically, existentially, I think so much deeper. I know I'm not just a volleyball player.
So I'd be curious because I don't want to create a binary, like it's not important. It's futile. It's superficial. Right. I agree with you, right, that there's healthy competition and it's really about finding the sweet spot of engagement, but not to the tune of self-destruction in preoccupation and what I would call obsession or a total fixation that you're a slave to the experience and you rob yourself from other aspects of life, relationships with others, the ability to love, the ability to connect, the ability to see purpose in other things. If I'm so consumed with something to the tune that I lose sight of my values, and that's my only value, that's a problem. But I'd be curious from my seat, have you ever come across people in the athletic community, right? I know people speak so highly of Coach John Wooden or players that sure. You're just like, wow, I so admire the person's character. I so admire the way they comport themselves, the way they show up, the way they speak to people, the way they engage their practice, their family, their discipline. Do you ever meet people like, wow, I so respect them?
I mean, obviously it's my own bias speaking now, but to me, it's been about people who seem to be really good at showing up and turning on the switch for volleyball. But there's this sense of, and I always revert to like sense of humor. If you can make a joke or have this like sense of humor button flipped on, and even now you can joke or you're talking about something serious, but there's always a time for a joke. To me, it's like a sign of, oh yeah, nothing really matters. It matters as much as it doesn't.
So by the way, my part of, you can't tell I'm funny. Maybe you can't. I don't think you could tell. But in my space, relative to other psychologists, I think I'm funny.
Yeah.
And I, so I'm not showing that, but I think that if you can't bring lightness, you have to, eventually we're going to have to bring some lightness to the story and humor. If you're going to work with me, it has to be funny. There has to be room for the funny and not taking ourselves so seriously.
Right.
Right. So that's a dimension that you saw in people. And I'm curious also, I would imagine that some of the people that you were talking about, they weren't the best players. Right. They may not have been the elite, but they just showed up to the experience in a way like you were like, wow, these are good, some good people.
Yeah. I mean, I guess in that sense, I always think about guys who actually normally didn't start or didn't play, who just seem to have a positive attitude and a work hard attitude no matter if they were playing or not. And a lot of times they knew they weren't playing. And I was like, how are you just showing up here? Like all happy to be here. And I've given examples in the past of guys who just like showed up and were having a good time and then left and were having a good time and everything just felt like, you know, it's all good. And they're working. We're doing the same amount. We're putting in the same amount of time, the same amount of hours. We still care the same, let's say. And those are the people I always looked up to, like as examples that still sit in my head as, I don't want to say people I want to be like, but parts of them that I try to reflect on. And I guess my thought originally, I was trying to get to the point of balance outside of volleyball, because you talked about video games, and I know so many players who a lot of times our job is 3 to 5, let's say practice is 3 to 5. That gives you an entire morning up until 3 to do whatever you want. Practice is over. You get home at 6, you make dinner, and you have until the rest of the night. And so many players I know who just play video games or numb out in some way. And again, I think there's nothing wrong with playing video games. There's nothing wrong with any of it. But as it, for myself, as I got older, I was like, and seeing that this was going to end at some point, it made me think and feel for all these people, like they're going to be done playing volleyball and then they're going to have no idea who they really are.
I've seen this before. So I, you remind me of someone I work with who was so elite in his sport. And I remember that at the age of 5, it started, meaning the schedule of his life was imposed upon him and this structure that no one else had. He was dedicated and a gifted athlete at such an early age, and it ended, and he was everything that one would want to be in that sport, and he just didn't know how to do life without, life was always giving him an intense structure, and he got to excel within it. And when that dissolved just because of age, right, in his early 30s, he just didn't know what to do. He was lost. And he had such ambition and big ideas about what to do, but no idea how to execute without, as a self-starter, none, right? Since everything was so built for him to succeed, right? And I remember just the challenge. And I think he was shocked because he was so used to this, you know, this high level of achievement in a space, and he couldn't replicate it as a self-starter.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. And I can imagine why, you know, and I know for myself, I've always been someone who has never identified as just a volleyball player, because I also feel like there's so much more to me, you know. And I guess as volleyball ending has started to loom, that's what's caused a lot in the last 3 years. I've kind of dealt with, let's call it, feelings of depression, feeling like I've been the best or one of the best at what I do for such a long time, and that's going to end. And like, I feel like I want to do something super unique. I don't want to just be a coach or like not have anything, not that I need to plan it, but like not have any idea of what else I'm interested in, and then just be like, your career's done. Welcome to the rest of us, be with the rest of us, you know, like I guess what I'm trying to hint at a little bit is like, do you think it's wise for athletes to cultivate balance in their life, and how can we go about doing that? You know, because to the point I made earlier, it's like, I just see people following this recipe that I have this feeling is not going to end well. And I'm aware of it now and have been for years.
I'm really happy for you that you got kicked out of one university and almost kicked out of another university.
Yeah.
It's a really, really good resume piece.
Sure.
No, because you know what setback is.
Sure.
You know what it's like to be on the brink of losing something you care about.
Sure.
So you're not, and you also know what it's like to self-correct. Right, you know what it's like to say, I've got to really, really do business differently. It's not what I thought would work really well was failing me, and I woke up and I changed, right? Mm-hmm. So that's a really, really, really good resume piece for how can I adjust to circumstances that can adjust to challenges of my own making, right? So even if I have a belief that the the only recipe for success is if I'm extraordinary and I stand out and I'm recognized. I'm not saying you have this. And this is the, I really, 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 the only acceptable grade is A++ excellence. If that's my challenge, and then I have to make a transition, right? I'm thinking about it, I wouldn't want to kill someone's passion and say, you know, hey, I want you to operate like, I want you to only phone in life. You're here, you are, you've been trained to not phone in anything. Every practice counts, right? Especially I'm imagining if you're on like the highest team, it's not cool to phone it in if you're on Team USA, right?
What do you mean exactly?
Meaning like, I don't care. I'm just going to do like a half-assed practice. I don't care. I'm not going to try. I'll just be like talking on my phone and just like hitting a ball.
It definitely doesn't work with the national team.
Yeah. Right. It's not a good look. Sure. At a minimum, it's not a good look to come hungover to practice and to be late and to not care, right? So there's a certain level of engagement that's not even, it's just the minimum standard. The minimum standard, right, at a desk job somewhere could be, there's such thing as phoning it in the real world, right?
Sure.
But in the team, national team world, I don't know if there's a concept of giving 20%,
sure,
quietly quitting.
Sure.
You ever hear these terms, you know,
yeah,
these days?
Sure.
I don't know if you're like, yeah, we're just quietly quitting. We're just doing national team till we figure things out. We don't really care.
Well, you know what, to that point, actually, I think people do.
Really?
And I don't know, like, I'll just in my own experience, like, and it's hard to say this without sounding like egotistical, but you get so good at something that in some way it's just the programming. It's already there. Like, we have these conversations all the time, the way we train, where I'm like, I don't need the 150 jumps a day, tons of reps. Like, I just need to stay healthy so I can compete, because it's a lot of it's there. It's like, now we're just talking about like little 0.5% of getting better at something. And I think in some way it does a disservice, because now I can show up, especially when I'm overseas, because everyone's it's very different. You know, on the national team, there's a little more, you're with all people from your country, and it's a little more of an honor. Let's say professionally, it's, we're getting paid and you're here to do your job, really. And in some way, I feel like you can get away with showing up hungover or not working so hard in the weight room. And we see guys do it all the time and come and ball out in the game. And it's like, damn, I just saw him like do 30 minutes of a workout, talk to a bunch of dudes and leave. And he's the best player on our team, you know? And I think that's, I don't know. I think it's a part of, for me, as I've gotten older, realizing like, that's what scares me the most almost, you know, is that we can get away with 20%. I mean, you called it calling in, like in some way you can, you know?
So welcome to the real world for those who are, you know, welcome to the real world of, you can't always give it your all. It's a good aspiration. It's good to strive. But what would I say to someone who's going from one thing to another, and that I want them to keep their engagement and their passion, but I also don't want them to lose their way in just creating like this endless competition and if it's painful to them, right? So how do I create the right balance of competition? So to me, what am I bringing to the table? So when we started here, right, you know, I really want to, we pre-gamed with how can I be helpful? So what words am I going to say that potentially can help somebody, right? That's my version of not phoning it in. That's my version of not just like doing anything. I want to set the intention of remembering. I woke up at 3:30 in the morning. I had like a super, super long day, right? This is my fun time, right? And I, you know, I'm sitting here with you and I get to talk, right? I don't want to drift in just being, you know, just spewing stuff. I want to hopefully say something that has some depth and weight and lightness, but could connect. So for me, right, and I, again, no athlete here, but I want to at least set some intention of what my purpose is and is it consistent with my values, right? So if I'm engaged in that way and I find something that I connect to, and I, let's say this is your podcast and this is your thing, right? It's not so much about winning viewers, right? Sure. It's way more about how can I enjoy this? How can I set an experience of having the right conversations with the right intention and the right spirit? And to me, right, it's about being of service. Who can I help? Who could I reach? Either in funniness, right? Sure. In lightness, in seriousness, like this conversation, right? But who can I reach and how can I channel being of service, really, right? How can I take what I've learned and give back? So if I come from that place and it's not just about exclusively about win, 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 I don't know. I may not be making the headlines of anything, but at 54 years old, that's kind of all right for me.
Yeah. And I don't know, I guess like for myself, I think a lot about volleyball now as like self-expression, and I care a lot about creative expression. I do creative writing, and I think I kind of want to keep staying a little bit on this idea, because I know there's so many people listening who, one second, I know there's a bunch of people listening who are pro athletes who are thinking and understanding that their career is going to end and are terrified because they don't know what's next. And I know for myself, it's like, I want to be able to express myself in the way that volleyball allowed me to do that. I've learned so much about myself, what I'm capable of through the medium of volleyball. And I want to continue that passion with something else. And I know it's not going to be just volleyball. And so I guess my thought for you is like, what would you say to that person who's, you know, they know their career is going to end, but they're like, I have no idea what I'm going to do when I'm done.
So humility, right, is the thing I would say most, which is at one point you were a student, right, of the game. Mm. And you said, I'm going to do whatever, I like it, I'm enjoying myself. At one point, it wasn't about, there was a time in your life when you probably didn't know what the national team was.
Definitely.
Right. Yeah. Right. I didn't even know it's called the national. I didn't know we had a national team. That's really cool. Well,
that's really cool.
I guess we're at Summer Olympics and everything, right? Mm-hmm. I think I knew that, but it's called national team. I didn't know that. So
Team USA.
I didn't know we called it a national team. I know Team USA. Yeah. I can see the Wheaties box or something. but at some point you were a passionate guy who was enjoying himself as a sponge with a natural affinity towards this thing. You were a natural, but you also were a sponge, and you were engaged and you were enjoying yourself. How do I find the humility? And the humility would be, how can I be a student again, teachable, honest with myself, right? Really, really honest with myself and teachable, and creating an experience of being open to learning and being curious again, like a total do-over, right? Because you were that at one point. You go back to your discussion of being a child. At some point in your life, you were you didn't come out of the womb, you know, spiking a volleyball.
Definitely not.
Right? So it probably took several years before you found your way to the volleyball court. How old were you?
I mean, I was 15. I was always playing soccer is what I thought I would do. But I found volleyball late, and to that point, fell in love with it as just like, I just love this thing. My friends love doing it. I'm going to do it all the time, and got addicted to volleyball.
Yeah. I understand. And I don't have all the answers. Like I wish our field did, but I'm speculating. There is a part of us that's super competitive and wants to engage in that way and has a, like, you know, this is primal. It's a real thing of drive, of competition. But how do I bring to that? What's the adult version of that that doesn't compromise me, but actually connects me more? And I, you know, I pay attention somewhat to different athletes and how they adjust. How they adjust to changes. So some of them could be the all-star and then just adjust to a role player and be great at it. Some of them couldn't do that for the life of them.
Sure.
And some of them who, and you can be really good this way, right? Just their whole engine, and I'm thinking of one right now, the whole engine sounds like a discussion of winning. Everything is winning. And it's inspired. I'm going to take all my resentment, everything, and my whole story I'm going to tell to the public is how I built upon resentment after resentment to prove right? I use each opportunity of disappointment to prove that I can overcome those who challenged me. And I love it. Now, I love it. So how do I take that and transition from the thing I was born with the biggest gift to becoming a student of life? I think it's hard for that person. I don't think of who I'm thinking of. I don't think it's so simple, right? And I'm looking at the people who do transition well to other things, mm-hmm. right? But they seem to take that curiosity, right? I think of Kobe Bryant, you know, and I think of what he was doing. What a tragic story, because I think he was beyond excited about his life after basketball, mm-hmm. and he was so good at it. And he was so good at it. And you can tell he brought the same curiosity, right? And he tended to other things outside of the basketball season.
Sure.
Right? He was building other aspects of his life. Or if you look like a guy like Kareem Abdul-Jabbar is writing in such interesting discussions and such interesting social commentary, right? And I say this all with a grain of salt because I don't really know sure. who's writing it. And I don't know the individuals. I think we have to be careful in my seat to diagnose public figures, because who knows, right? Who knows what's what? But I think that some people take that same curiosity and engagement and just become brand new and sponges again with humility. You don't have to, they can't start off the best.
Yeah, and I think that's a lot. That's, at least for me, like, it's so interesting because you describe, and I think a lot of people would, these like high performing athletes as so competitive and dialed in, and that is their life. And I know many of them. And it's so interesting because for myself, I've always been like just this kid of just like, I just get to do the thing that I love doing. And a lot of days as I've gotten older, it feels like a job, you know. But for me, I'm coming at it with this angle of like, I don't, at least maybe it's like layered in of this, like, I need to win. I definitely know since I was young, I was really competitive and wanted to be the best at whatever I did. And that's more of how I view it. And that's the part I think that scares me definitely, is feeling like I know that I'm going to enter I'm going to become a baby at 34 or 5 or whenever I decide to stop, you know? And that part is definitely really terrifying, I think. I just know that there's so many people that I've had conversations with as professional volleyball players. Some of them, in some way, I feel like some people don't think about it at all because they're consumed in it right now. Like, what do you foresee being a potential, and we're a couple of speculators right now, but what do you foresee being like problems in the future because we were so hyper-focused on this lifestyle that only, I don't know, point whatever percent of people get to do, you know?
So I see the same thing I see with people who retire early and they think it's the best thing in the world. Mm. Some of them can't do it. They don't know how to transition from being the structure of engagement to no structure. Mm. And they sleep, right? And they deteriorate, right? And they lose purpose. And it's not just a sometimes thing. It's an often thing, right? I had this guy I work with. I'll never forget him. I work with this kid, and he made like retirement early age business money, like on Wall Street, I think.
Wow.
And I remember he worked as on a construction crew somewhere for a couple years. That's what he did. He was just a worker, right? This guy was like a beast in industry, right? Got to retire in his early 40s. And he just collected a brand new experience from the bottom. Now, what kind of character has the strength to be comfortable being the top dog, right? And then going to just being the new guy who's a worker, right? Yes, wow. And so I've seen people engage it in a curious way. And you see, I speculate about the people who find other interests, and you see them, or they stay adjacent to the sport, right, that they love. But the pitfall is the person who can't make an adjustment, right? They just don't know how to, they're so locked into the routine that they can't see anything else. And then they become so disappointed. They become defeated.
And to that point of feeling so disappointed and defeated, I feel like while my career is not over, and I kind of want to move into a bit of like anxiety, depression a little bit. And I think for myself, that's what's cultivated these feelings that have gotten heavier and heavier over the last 3 years of depression around this idea that I don't know what it's going to look like. And so I know there's so many people who, I'm sure everyone in some way can relate to anxiety before a podcast or depression based on whatever, but I don't know, in your mind, like how do you view, I don't know, I don't want to say like blankly like depression, but when people come to you and they have these feelings and emotions or things in their life they can point to that have caused depression, where do you begin to like help them dissolve or rather better understand those feelings and how to navigate them?
So I look at depression, there's depression as a clinical syndrome, right? Where it's like a cyclical
chemical thing.
Where it's a cyclical disease, like you have bouts of depression, right? And I'm a person who's in the world, all of a sudden I start like I'm overcome with sadness or I don't enjoy my life. I don't enjoy the things I usually like. And that comes with I'm not sleeping well, or I'm sleeping a lot, or my appetite changes, my sleep patterns change. I have difficulty concentrating and engaging. I look at the world and the future as hopeless. Sometimes I even think it would be better to die. I go through this, and then I come out the other side, and then I go through another wave of it. And it's just, I'm a depressive. I lose my energy. And that's like the condition, clinical depression. Mm. And I'm not, so as a standalone, like that's my thing. I see that sometimes, but I also see this. I'm so afraid of something and I'm so worried and preoccupied with what my future and the uncertainty, because I can't control the future. And uncertainty is I hate the uncertainty so much. I don't know what's going to happen. It could go good. It could go not good. I dread. Mm. I dread the potential of things going south. And I live in that story so often. And eventually, what's going to happen to me? What's going to happen to me? Is it going to be bad? It's going to be bad. Eventually, I'm so tired of that story, I get defeated. And that morphs, that turns into what I would call an anxiety-driven depression. So I'm so caught up in the storyline of what's going to happen to me. Now, in reality, right, most of the things that are going to happen to the people, nobody's dying, sure. Right? But in our own head, right, it's so important to us, what's going to happen to me? Probably I'm going to be fine, sure. Right? But the dread of it is I might not be. And it's so tiring to live in the story that eventually I get tired and defeated. And then comes that sense of hopelessness. And I look into the future and I can't see anything that's going to be good. And I live in that sort of, I put onto the future, it's going to be bad. And I live in that space. So in my understanding of mental health, it's so much of it is understanding what's going on and how the narrative, the story I tell myself, even if I know it's not true, right? Mm-hmm. So let's take an athlete. You're probably going to be fine. You're not moving to a war zone in Syria anytime soon.
Sure.
Right? Hopefully you're right. Not. Unless you're probably not going to be stuck in the worst of worst situations. So, but it doesn't really matter because to me, even if I know it intellectually, I'm experiencing it as such pain. So I don't think so. There are obviously some people take medication, right, as a go-to, mm-hmm. because it sort of quiets the noise of this discussion and the stress around it. But in addition to that, right, some people, I really believe you have to take certain actions that are so contrary to that story.
Like what? Like, I would love to know the tools that you recommend or places to begin for people who are feeling.
So if I'm in it, it depends what type of depression I'm in. I remember a patient saying to me, he was older. He said, tell your younger people they have to make their bed every day. Hmm. This guy wanted to drive his car off.
Some dude made a book about that. Didn't he?
This guy, yeah, he wanted to drive his car off a cliff. right? Wow. And he said with such sincerity, make sure you make your bed. Make sure you wake up in the morning, right? Be careful how you talk to yourself, right? Spend a lot of energy capturing themes in your thought life that are depression makers, right? If you're using language, there's certain language that should, always, must, have to, right? Mm. Those sorts of words, right, are perfectionistic words, like looking at the future as it's going to be bad and really, really telling a story. Doing this at 2 a.m. when it's like you're on generator power, what are you doing?
Sure.
Nothing. Don't take anything you think so seriously then, right? Sure. There are higher suicide rates then. So a lot of the work that people talk about with depression in particular, and anxiety too, is thematic patterns of thought life, thematic patterns that are typical, what we would call distortions, right? That lead to, they're the fuel of the symptoms. So in depression, right? If I'm an athlete, for example, if the only success is starting, right? That's my narrow, I have such a narrow room for a success. It's either that or I'm a total failure. Mm. That's a depression maker, right? If I'm transitioning from volleyball into the world, if being recognized in the same way I was as an athlete is my metric only,
you're fucked.
Then your standard is so rigid, right?
Yeah, sure.
So everything else is a depression maker.
Sure.
So that all or nothing pattern of thinking, if I can't recognize good stuff that's going on, right? We talk about disqualifying or discounting good stuff, and I fixate on the 3% of my life that's not working, or the 10%, and I dismiss the 90% that's working. That's a depression maker. Mm. So the things, and these are sort of, they've become pretty standard self-help books about cognitive distortions. I mean, you can look it up. Just look up cognitive distortions and you'll see if you're a depressed person or an anxious person, these patterns of thinking really, really, really are the fuel of depression. So I can take a stand. I can take a stand on myself. The other thing I would say is, I mean, obviously, you know, like some of the behavioral stuff is sleep and, you know, being active, sure, is all important.
Healthy diet,
I'm a big, big meditator. I'm a big believer for myself in meditation. And I kind of did the hippie kind. And I like
a nice little pillow. And
no, it's not hippie kind like that. It's kind of do it anywhere. Even if you're at Starbucks and even if you're on a plane, you can just do it.
Yeah.
Just park yourself and do it. And it doesn't, you don't have to have the ideal conditions. But for me, there is a big difference between the story of my ego and the story of life, the greater purpose life.
Yeah.
So the story of my ego is always about winning and losing, and I'm not going to have enough, and what's going to happen to me, and what problem can I solve? But there's a more connected story.
I have like the usual thoughts and questions, which are the obvious ones too, which are like, you know, when people talk about meditation, and I've been meditating for a long time as well, and the practical, I'll do it while I'm driving, and I feel like I'll have a lot of experience with it. And yet I still find like quieting the mind is like, what is ego? Like, why is it there? Because it seems that we all have it and we all struggle with it. Like, is it just a part of being?
So we're not, so now we're out of the realm of, I mean, listen, I think the field of psychology, definitely rips off, you know, the East, and we call it mindfulness, but really we're borrowing from a long tradition of, you know, many, many, you know, millennia, you know, at this point, and or centuries, I should say. And
is that reptilian DNA? What's going on back there?
I'm just thinking about how to package this. So your question is, Here's with all, you have this active mind. It's probably very, very loud. It talks a lot. You can't shut it off. Meditation doesn't even shut it off. Even though we would like to say meditation shuts it off, it doesn't really shut it off, right? It doesn't really shut off the mind. So what's the point? What's the purpose? So to me, I really like the guys in India. That's where, you know, the people who are teaching meditation in India, there's a certain, I like what they're about. And I like, at least the way I hear it from the people who translate it for me here, is they're talking about a story other than the story. So the meditation takes me to a place other than the I have to win, what's going to happen to me, what am I going to do in the future, sure, what about my relationship, am I going to have enough, am I going to keep what I have,
blah, blah, blah. Well, doing it with purpose is missing the point almost, right?
What do you mean?
Like doing meditation for a purpose of something is, yeah, missing the point of doing, yeah, it.
But doing meditation to see if you collect an experience, meaning I only know this because I've had the experience. It's not about, so it's a hard thing to talk about. It's a hard thing to talk about unless you see if it works, right? So mm-hmm. What I like about it is if it doesn't work, don't do it. So what has it been for me? Because I can speak for me. It's just like, oh, there's something else besides just my thought life. So what's the purpose of my thought life? I think it's designed to connect me to something else. So if used properly, and you know, I was thinking about it when you were talking about this idea, if used properly, here you are, you've had an experience that so few people have had, right? How do I bring, and when I train therapists and psychologists, I you know, some of them come in really much older and like really, really with a lot of self-doubt. I haven't been in school in a while. What am I going to do? I don't know this. I'm like, you have so much to bring. I'm like, what do I have to bring? You have to bring light. You get to bring your life experience. So you have something to bring from your experience that could be, that you could draw upon always. When I worked with a person who like grew up in this like really, really, really tough gang situation. I'm like, and you know, here this individual got educated and wanted to give back as a therapist and was intimidated by the academic part of things. I'm like, you? You have so much more to bring. Bring it. So here I bring what you could bring. You offer something. You offer, you know, you really know what crisis is, right? Bring it. Bring the calm. Mm. Bring, you've had countless experiences. Bring your experience. So when I think of the meditation experience, right? I'm bringing an experience. I'm not talking about an idea. I'm talking about an experience. So if I'm you and I'm embarking on what's next, I'm thinking to myself, oh, I can bring so much no matter what arena I'm in, right? I know what pressure is. I know what unity is. I know what it's like to have bad partnership. I know the importance of partnership. I think when I say partnership, I mean team building.
Sure.
Right? Because if you have a fractured team, it's probably terrible.
Sure.
Right? Yeah. That's a speculation on my part.
I mean, it's a well speculated.
It probably sucks when people are really
or checked out. It happens, right, a lot.
Or hostile season. Or yeah. Like bitter with each other, and yeah, they're carrying resentment and they don't resolve it and it doesn't get spoken, yeah, about. You can probably feel the tension and it could be bad, right? Leadership, right? There's so much experience you could bring. And if you are in the position of helping someone, you have a lot to give just based on your experience.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's really beautiful how you worded that. And I also feel like, and again, I'm like a little subjected to this experience I had in the last month. And a part of that was feeling like I was doing the cold baths, I was doing the sauna, as I was meditating, I was felt like I was doing all the right things. And yet I still had this like overwhelming compulsive thought trains or thought holes that I would just get sucked into and felt like, what the fuck do I need to do? Like, and I know that there's other people who feel similarly, where maybe I eat a good diet, I'm still competing objectively, everything's fine, and yet I still feel like what is the next step then?
So if it were me and I was it would be more of a question of not so much how come I'm doing all the right things and nothing's working. It would be, the question would be a little different. It would be, what do I have to surrender? What am I holding on to? Doesn't matter that you meditate, exercise, and are a vegan. It doesn't matter, right? What am I holding on to? What is so important to me that I can't let go of? Because I can meditate all day long, right? And do check all the boxes. What am I holding on to? And what would it look like to let go of that thing? And whatever it is, right? So you know, I can get super preoccupied with like, I got to retire by 65. I got to be able to, right? I'm like, at a certain point, I'm like, that's arbitrary. Who said that? What the fuck are they talking about? Mm. Right? Like, what are they saying? Who said that, right? But I have a rule. I have a thing that's become super important to me, right? And so preoccupying. And I want to quiet the noise, but until I'm willing to let, there's something that I need to let go of for me to breathe again. And I got to find the thing that I'm holding on to. And it's usually some sort of thing that I'm on the chase for, an experience. Either I want to avoid the pain or while I want to experience something or some combination of both. And what am I willing to let go of? And eventually it comes. I work with somebody who had a really good experience with this. And he was like, he had to find purpose in being self-sufficient. He came from money. And he just let go of the pressure to be sort of fill the big shoes. Just let go. It's like, he's like, I'm done on that. I'm done with the chase of filling the shoes of I've got to prove myself. And, you know, the guy was suicidal, you know, literally.
Yeah.
And, but that's what he needed to let go of, because he was suicidal because he was so tired of trying to fix himself, quote unquote, right? And all the things that he finally got underneath what was really going on. And it was about letting go of something. I don't know if that helps.
Oh, definitely. I just, when you're talking, I'm thinking just also about people who are just so unaware or haven't gotten to a point in their life, especially athletes, who are really thinking about the next step or thinking about the potential addictions or things that are going on in their lives. They're not even aware of them as a potential issue. And in some way, I'm just like, do we all need a therapist? Like, obviously, being in a psychiatrist, like, you know, you thought it was an important enough field to really dive into. And in some way, that's, at least in my experience in therapy, I'm like, I almost don't trust someone if they don't have a therapist. You know?
So like, I don't know if we all need a therapist, but I definitely, especially for people who think a lot and who have a lot going on in their head and feel like they're like, just shut up, right? Like if there's so much noise, it's really good to have a trusted person to speak to. You know, shamans, priests, right? They often served the function, right, of the community person who listened, the barber, right?
Right,
who, you know, the bartender on some level, right? The person who you shared with. So the most important thing is, do people know me really well? Do I let myself be known, and do people know my story? Because like I said, it's like an oil change, right? I got to be able to let it out. And so is it helpful to do it with someone who you trust? If you like the person you're talking to, it's really important that you, the individual, likes the experience of the person you're talking to and trust them, and that they like you too. Right? Even if they're getting paid, that they feel good about the connection is probably, and you're motivated to talk. Those are probably the biggest ingredients of effectiveness.
Do you like have a therapist, or what does that look like in your life? I'm so interested.
So I had he died last year, unfortunately, but I had a guy that was my guy, and he was my everything. Like I brought all my work stuff to him and he was sort of like, he was my senior, and I'm like, I want to be like him. He had a lot of things in life that I wanted. He had a lot of recovery and addiction space, and he had strong and sturdy and sort of he was the wise sage, you know, the wise guy, the wise older guy. And I just like, I'm going to see him every week. And I did that for years and years and years. And I actually, I gave a tribute to him after he died. As he was dying, actually, he couldn't come. I gave a talk presented on his writing, and he was my guy. And I just found my guy, right? And it became more symbolic too. It became such a part of my life that I don't know if I needed the space. I don't know if I needed to talk about things, but it became so helpful, almost like, you know, just like I need to take a shower, you know, I need to just something I need to do. Who's the person who I'm going to tell everything to?
Yeah. And I mean, it sounds from everything we've talked about, it just feels like it's all about the story we tell ourselves. And I feel like in some way, if you don't have an environment where you can project that into the world a little bit to get another perspective other than your own, at least I've experienced in my own life, it can be really toxic.
For yourself.
For yourself.
It's correct. A big burden to carry.
Yeah.
Right? Because that means I'm the judge and jury of my own thought life. Mm. Be careful.
Yeah, definitely.
Right.
Yeah. And I don't know. I have, in some way, I felt just so compelled to, like, I just am constantly like, everyone should have an outlet. And like, how much do you think environment plays a role? Obviously, when it comes to addiction and things, I'm sure your environment, the people you see every day, has a huge impact on what you get into a little bit. But do you think that there's, like, how can someone begin to create a healthy environment for themselves or create a space, especially when being overseas is so isolating? It can make you feel like a lot of, at least for myself, like I don't have the just little things like social interactions with people who speak my language, you know, and those things start to compound over so much time. And I'm in some way I've like really wanted to find a way to create a space as part of what this podcast is to kind of try to connect and unite people in some way.
So community. So just, I don't think you need one thing, right? You need, you know, physical, you know, mind, body, spirit, right? It's not one thing. So it's everything. Mm-hmm. So I need my guy, right? My person. And I need a community. I need, and these days I really, really, it's important for me to protect the environment I'm in. I don't want, it's hard for me to be with people who are going to, you know, who don't share my values or, you know, there was somebody I saw recently. I'm like, you know, and I thought, you know, you can connect me with all. I'm like, you know what? It's probably not healthy for me to be in that person's arena. Mm. Right. And so kind of knowing what keeps me balanced, you used that word earlier, what can keep the balance. So I have to protect my environment. So being alone in a foreign country, you know, how would I retain community? What's interesting, what happened in the pandemic is that Zoom really kept alive wellness communities. So in the arena of 12 step, you had like, just like a, like all of a sudden, you know, like a, like just this, it blew up like all these meetings.
Cause convenience level. Went
and up, it became, it's really still, I think it's still more the norm now, even than live meetings is to have Zoom meetings. And all of a sudden there was a whole, you know, the orbit of community just went from locals to international so quickly. Mm. So you have people connecting, you know, Australia, UK, LA, you know, China, and they're all in this wellness community together, which is pretty cool. It is cool. So I think that there's a way to maintain community, but having a squad of people who you can be authentic with and who know that you can be your imperfect self with them. Mm. I just think it's mission critical for me.
Mm. I mean, what's the biggest changes you've seen in your lifetime of, you know, I can imagine like access to a therapist or, you know, even with social media and some of these topics being brought more up because you'll see them on your feed now because mental health awareness stuff is becoming so much more prevalent. Like, do you see a pros and cons? Do you see like, you know, I can imagine 40 years ago, there was like, who did you talk to? Who was talking about those things?
So,
you know, like
I don't know if they were talking. So like we said earlier, I one of the takeaways from the discussion for me is balance. Mm. So it's not, I'm just a volleyball player and that's my only identity. It's about how do I make room for more than one thing, right? Mm. How can I be both things? How can I be both competitive and compassionate, right? How can I be engaged in and focused, but also, you know, maintain other interests? So when I think of mental health, we were saying earlier that I can get so preoccupied with it. Mental health awareness, like it's like mental health on steroids. Mm. Were there mental health issues throughout the ages? Sure. You know, right? Like if you look at the Bible, like they're sort of highlighting, you know, some pretty effed up stories, for sure. Right? So they're trying to say that crazy stuff went on. The people were acting crazy, jealous, killing each other, right? You know, there was infidelity. There were all these things going on.
It's like there's a thousand ways to tell the same story,
right? So yeah. There's a lot, even in some of the, you know, the traditions that I've been reading lately. You're talking about like some one god beheads another god, mm-hmm. right? But it's a message. There's a humanity and they're identifying struggle early on. So how do I find the right balance of self-examination and then participating and letting go? And like we said earlier, there's a right time and place for everything. But I do think, so what have I noticed in the world lately? The pandemic hit hard. It hit hard on teens. There's like this, like whatever we're seeing, it's on steroids. And to me, if I'm isolated too much, it's not, I need community. I need to be a part of things. There's something about the human interaction that's really important. Mm. And I don't know if exclusive engagement of computer to computer, right, is going to get it done. Mm. So, but there's always been, so what do I like about the current teen climate? They're very ready to talk about it. They have language that I didn't have growing up about emotional expression. So done with the appropriate mix of living and knowing when not to talk is probably really healthy.
You talked a little about surrender too. And I wonder sometimes, like I always make the joke, like I wish I was, like I grew up really religious. I mean, my parents were both Christian and I always thought as I got older, like, damn, sometimes I wish I was just like convinced, you know, and I believed in the story of Jesus Christ and the Bible in general as a way of like being grounded. Because I can imagine being Jewish, like you have some, like, how do you feel like your view of the world or in religion helps ground you as a person? Because I could imagine, like, I mean, how many athletes do we see say, like, you know, this one's for God or like I give it up to God. Like, I can imagine that's so powerful, you know?
So that's not a powerful driver for me.
Hmm.
So growing up with religious teachings, probably it wasn't very inspirational.
Hmm.
The biggest inspiration is seeing that my narrative doesn't work. So pain is the best teacher for me.
Sure.
So my own internal pain, when I want something and I start chasing it and I realize, and when I wake up to the fact, if I keep doing business my way, it's never going to work. I'm not a guy who starts off with great ideas. Hmm. I think I'm outsmarting and then I met with pain. And that's where I get the most growth. Kind of like when you, you know, were about to lose your career. That's when you woke up, right? It wasn't, Jesus didn't wake you up. You were more woken up by, oh my God, my identity is about to be destroyed.
Sure.
It's time to take a serious look.
Sure.
Right? So pain is the best teacher for me. And it's usually the pain of exposing the parts of me that don't work. So at that point, I'm listening way more to other things that aren't my narrative. I'm ready. I'm a student. When the student is ready, the teacher appears.
Hmm.
I'm ready at that point. Otherwise, I'm just sort of going through the motions of I can make it all work. And I'm not a good, I make bad decisions historically.
Yeah. Do you, like
I haven't in a long time, but I'm saying my younger self made bad decisions.
Yeah, sure.
Some, not everybody was like that. Some people made really good decisions.
Sure. Man, I just always felt like I was the guy who had to fuck it up to learn the lesson.
Yeah.
Like, no, Michael Jordan, when I was 18, couldn't have been like, dude, you got to stop. You got to like figure out social, like balancing social life and volleyball. You're going to fuck this up. Like, it wouldn't have mattered. Like, hey, don't smoke weed on Michael Jordan. Like, none of that would have mattered to me, you know?
Right.
Like, in some way, I've almost, as like I try to cultivate, because I've spoken with teams and kids before about like kind of my story and what I learned. And it's so hard because the summary of it to me is never like, well, don't do bad things. In some way, I've been like, actually, like,
do what you gotta do.
Fuck it up.
Right.
Like, I in some way feel like, and I even as an adult now, I'm like, hey, go fuck it up. The podcast video guy got fucked up. There's a lesson to learn. You're like, so much of now, I think rather than trying to like, hey, avoid the mistake I made, I feel like now I'm teaching, like, go learn it on your own.
Well, I don't think you're gonna say, I don't think For some people, not everyone, just because it's a good idea not to smoke weed doesn't mean they're gonna have to have the experience themselves. And maybe that's the type of learner I am and you are. Maybe that's the way that we learn best, is by thinking that we know better, doing it our way, and then almost getting kicked out of the school.
Sure.
And then and then saying I'm awake and I'm open to things. And I'm open to a lot of things, right? Will I find Christianity at that point? Possibly, right? Will I be open to other things and other messages? Probably, right? But when I'm in my sort of like, when I'm a bull in a china shop, nothing's going to stop me. So you're right. What's the point?
So do you share that? You feel like you were the type of person that had to learn, I guess we all learn the hard way, but like really had to make the mistake to really be able to pivot rather than someone.
Absolutely. Who... That my initial reflex is bad decision. Yeah. Now it's just the way I rolled. Yeah. You know, I don't know exactly why, but it's just how I learn things. Yeah. But then I learn.
Yeah.
And the good news is once I have the clarity of mind and the presence of mind, and this is one of the benefits if you're struggling with substance, if you put away a substance and you have room to self-examine properly, you can actually learn lessons. Part of the problem with using substances is it's really hard to make the room for substances and learning lessons. Right? Sure. It's really, really crippling. Like
it's easy to rationalize
that. I once went to a lecture at UCLA here, and it was about it was from the VA, and they were talking about ideas of people who have like experienced trauma in combat. And one of the ideas was let them talk to a person like me as quickly as they can so that they can, you know, sort of unpack and unburden themselves from the crazy thing things that they saw. But there was this theory, I don't know if they ever tested it, was like, no, give them opiates, snow them, just get them as high as you can, right? Get them as high as possible so you get them on a cellular level so they can block the learning process. And I thought to myself, I didn't think about it through the lens of trauma, but I thought about it through the lens of learning, is that substances impact, the theory was substances or being high impacts my ability to grow and learn from experiences. I'm like, true. Very true. So they interfere with my development. So that's why when I'm working with people who have addiction problems, they're mature, right? They're still adolescent. There's still an adolescent quality to 40-year-old drug addicts.
And you feel the same with like nicotine, for example. Like I feel like a lot of people who were addicted to some heavy substance and got off it, like end up just smoking cigarettes until they
and
die.
Dying of emphysema. You know? Yeah, I think that there's controversy about that, but I think that it's the lesser of evils, and it's a process. So you may drop one and pick up another, and then eventually you drop that. But I hear you. But it's a big difference blocking a learning process with heroin versus cigarettes. I'm not saying they're good, right? I'm not saying they're good and they kill, but sure. I still need something. But on some level, even cigarettes, I'm not fully open to learning everything without having a crutch.
And do you feel like eventually, I have always described myself as having a super addictive personality. And in some ways, it's served me really well. And in other ways, it's been damaging to my life. Do you think that's something that just, if you're that type of person, that's just going to be who you are and you got to learn how to like gear it towards healthy things? Or do you think it's something you can overcome and learn to surrender? And
no, I don't think the voices of self-criticism go away. I don't think the preoccupations go away. I think it's more about learning how to adjust to the voices in my head. And if you look at the people who have addictive personalities, they tend to do well in life. They tend to climb in industry. They love getting promotions. They love the competition.
A Western way of success.
Western way of success. Sure. So, but they definitely love the opportunities to win. And they love the challenge of the win. And so again, I don't want to be binary. There are parts of it that are adaptive, but most of all, I would say to somebody who struggles with that is it's an opportunity to connect. Use it as a catalyst to say, how can I connect to myself and what I'm really searching for? Because what I'm really searching for is feeling good. And I want to feel better than I do, right? Freud talked about this idea of the pleasure principle. I know that he, you know, people talk about his death instinct. I don't know if I buy that, but ultimately I just want to feel good. And maybe the story of the chase is really a way to reflect back inward, is that I can feel good. It starts inside, not outside, right? It's not the thing I'm going to get. It's not about the winning. I think it is. I think it is. It's supposed to be.
You mean that like it's in the feeling you
it's
get?
It's an inside job, means that if I'm feeling grounded and connected, that's the thing. What I'm always looking for is right here. And I think part of the addictive personality you called, right, is like I'm always looking for something. And so what I realize over time is that I'm just looking in the wrong, I'm looking what I'm looking for, I'm looking with, type of thing.
Sure.
Right. Yeah. And it's right here. It's a quiet inside job. And that's like, you know, June 2, 2023, I may change my mind the next time you speak to me. But I do think that, I'm not saying you don't participate in the world, but that, but part of the thing that that addict person is looking for is, I just need that to be okay. I need that to have that experience. I'm collecting these experiences that I have to have to be okay. And real, but it's on some level, they're, you know, they're big searchers.
You know, and I think just to slowly wrap things up here too, I feel like in my own personal life, a part of that has been also acknowledging that sometimes, even though I want to feel good, sometimes I'm going to feel bad. And let's just accept that. And as someone who cares about like creativity and creative expression, I've found that like in surrendering to that emotion, it actually allows for access for so much more creativity. Because now, rather than having to show up as like the guy who makes funny volleyball content or like this specific person that I present myself as, now I have an opportunity to share on such a deeper level and have it be so authentic to and translate into the world as like, this is how I am now, you know?
Right. So, I think the other, because you're touching on a lot of addiction themes to me. Mm. One of them is that discomfort is really bad. Mm. Right. So what you're talking about is embracing the disease and using it as a connecting point. And some people in a meditation way, you would say really, really, instead of get out of your head and into the body and connect to the sensations that you're experiencing and be curious about the sensations of discomfort, even when you're experiencing them. So it isn't rooted just in the story, but part of the, I think the addiction experiences is that being uncomfortable is terrible. And maybe that's not true, is what you're saying.
Yeah. Well, and some, the irony for me is like, I'm also someone who loves discomfort. I mean, in order to change your body drastically, you have to exert yourself in ways that are very discomforting.
Right. But you are in charge of that. At least you control that.
Right.
It's discomfort that feels out of your control that probably feels bad. Right. It's when it happens to you, quote unquote, right? That you don't want it. Or when you're not invited, that it feels that you wish it weren't there. And
yeah, or wondering why it's there. Like, why can't I just sit at 7 p.m. and watch a movie and just enjoy the movie? Why does it feel like there's this extra thing? And in part of the work I've done with this somatic therapist, who really helped me get in touch with this idea of like, first, there is a feeling that exists. And maybe this is like debatable for a lot of people, but the concept of that there is something that exists inside you, there's a feeling that's attached to an emotion, that it's attached to a thought or the thought process. It's been really helpful for me because it's like taught me to shut the fuck up and listen.
Right. It's got you out of your head.
Right.
Right, which is really, really, and you're connecting to something other than your head.
Right.
So that's a really good thing.
Yeah, and I think having the space for, you know, like what a part of what you do, being able to listen in a way that makes people feel heard and safe and really speak from.
I really talk a lot too.
Do you?
I interrupt people all the time.
Yeah?
I think so, yeah. But they still come back and they still, but I do talk a lot.
That's interesting.
Yeah. You mean I talked a lot. If we do the study of the percentage of time I talked versus you talked, I probably talk way more than you.
But you know what? In fact, like I caught myself multiple times being like, it's hard. I'm listening, but I had so many times I wanted to like interject. This was honestly like, I'm being selfish now. This was super helpful and good for me just to like be with someone who carried a lot of the conversation. And this gave me a unique opportunity to like really work on listening because I find you so fascinating. I think you're the coolest dude. Like,
well, this is a lot of fun, and I'm glad we made it work with a camera disruption.
Yeah.
Right. I don't even know if the recording worked.
It did for an hour and 15 minutes of it.
Dude, thank you so much. Mr. Dr. Adams Silverstein, dude.
That's me.
I appreciate it. If anyone wants to like get involved, I know you had a podcast. Hopefully this is the spark that ignites the flame again.
I'm obsessed with a different line of study, but I did it for all the wrong reasons. But my daughter-in-law is a podcast producer. So
oh wow.
Right.
So interesting.
Her name is Leia. And so yeah, there's a chance I'll get back into that.
But for anyone who's interested in like, I don't know, learning more about you or what you do, and I don't want to like say like, you know,
just give them my number.
Yeah.
Just give them my number.
Google search them. That's what I did.
Yeah, just give them my number. 818-612-2622.
Give him a call. He did it, dude.
Give me a call.
Give him a call.
And I'll either call you back or I won't.
Based
right?
in LA.
Yeah, and I'm not really selling anything. But yeah, if they guess what if they want if they had a question, they could text me. That's where I hold my phone. I hold my phone like a limb. So I guess that they can that's the best way to find me, right? I'm not gonna read my email as much as I would look at my phone. Right? Hey.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Truly appreciate it, you guys.
Dude, I mean like where I don't know where you're not I'm not gonna I don't want them to come to my house. Like true. I don't have a website. I don't do that. Yeah, I guess I've my cell phone. Like where else?
Do you promote where else? Yourself? Like is that even something you want or need
I
to do?
Probably should. And my secret sauce has been I do a lot of training of people. Hmm. So I think this is the story I tell myself. Hmm. I didn't do really any social media or web or advertising. You know, like I did nothing.
You crush on TikTok. You learn from Danny. He teach you.
What's that?
You can learn from Danny. He teach you how to crush on TikTok.
I don't know how to do it. I don't even know how to turn it on. Well, now he told me that I have to comment on all his things.
Yeah.
So can I say that on it's recording.
To
yeah.
Boost the algorithm.
There's three things. There's a heart.
Slim Dan.
I have to hit a heart. I have to hit a heart. There is a comment. And then there's one other thing. I've got another symbol that I hit. There are three things.
You got to share it.
What's that?
Save it.
Anyhow, three things. So cool. I don't do that. So the story that my speculation is that there's a buzz around me as like a good teacher. Hmm. So the younger students who train under me and then become people respect me, and they create like, oh, he's good at this. That's how I exploit the younger people who don't know better, and I just say a few smart things like, wow, he's smart. But then like 10 years later, like he wasn't that smart, right? So, but that's how I think. So the only thing I have is a telephone number.
Dang, I love that.
I mean, I have an email, but I don't. I would. There's so many that I hate email.
You face.
I love telephone.
I hope.
I don't face.
Share your email with Holly.
My email? Oh, I have my own email. Okay. Yeah.
I really hope people call you.
818-612-2622. Can you imagine?
FaceTime.
No, don't FaceTime. FaceTime, I won't answer. Well, lately, do you ever get texts like, "Hi, is this Michael?" I'm like, "No, who's this?" "Oh, I'm so sorry." And then they start trying to talk to you.
No, what?
Yeah. I know, so I hope it's not that.
Don't click the link, dude. If someone sends you a link,
I don't treat it like that. But if they text me and say if somebody were listening and they're like, I don't know how many, like, and they said, "Hey, I heard this podcast. You said I can text you or call you." I'm like, okay. I mean, dude. Seriously, if I get one text like that, I'd be surprised.
Really?
I mean, seriously, nobody's gonna text me,
dude. You'd be surprised how much people want help, though. You know?
Can you imagine? Hi, I heard you on a
flood the inbox,
I heard you
dude,
on the
flood
what's the
inbox.
Name of the podcast?
Tallest podcast
on Earth. I heard the tallest podcast. I heard you on the tallest podcast on Earth. I have a question for you about surrender.
You're the man. Thank you so much. I love you, buddy. Thank you.